Welcome to the BFM Historical Society. This week, we talk to Andrew Boak, one of the original Andrews, and a former assistant station manager at BFM. Andrew tells us about the strange circumstances that led him to sing backing vocals on a Dead Kennedys record, and about the long musical journey from No Tag to selling Deep House records in San Francisco. Welcome to the BFM Historical Society, Andrew Boak.
Welcome. It's great to be here.
Now, we'll start at the beginning. When did you first come up to BFM, and what was your first involvement with the station?
I came up, actually, I think, with a demo tape of my band then, which was the Regulators, and got kind of interested, and then ended up at Auckland University and said, you know, I'm going to come and get on the radio. It was 1980, and that was my introduction to BFM, Radio B, as it were. I did a Bachelor of Commerce. Well, I didn't do a Bachelor of Commerce, but that's what I was enrolled on the books for doing. So who wants to go and sit in the lecture when you can come up and listen to the latest tunes, you know? You know, it was Mike and Florence and Andrew Topping, I think, were the people that were up here. Basically came up and hung around so much that it was like, you know, yeah, if you hung around enough, you got to get a show during the day. And you got to remember back then that this was also before we went 365 days a year. So the only time it was on air was during orientation. So the rest of the time you were just broadcasting to the quad out of some very nice big speakers.
BFM would have still been AM at that time.
Absolutely. Yeah. It was Radio B.
Radio B.
Bosom. Yep. Well, actually, we changed to Radio B then. So because trying to, I don't know if it was trying to get rid of the Bosom moniker, but it was definitely, you know, a new name, new attitude, new logo, that kind of thing. It was basically the two types of licenses you could have was full-time or 28 days. And someone sat down once and said, well, who says we can't apply for a bunch of 28 days altogether?
Consecutively.
Yeah, and yeah. The Broadcasting Tribunal said, fine by us. And, you know, the full-time stations got a bit pissed off about it and said, you know, well, that's not fair. But the Broadcasting Tribunal really wanted to develop alternative radio. It was university radio that they really wanted to get going as well. So they said yes, and away we went. At that time, there was a lot of stuff that was coming from the major labels here, I guess, but it was the kind of indie stuff that there was no way they were going to get ZM or Hauraki or anyone like that to play it. And so we were their outlet, and we really enjoyed that because it gave us new stuff to thrash the living daylights out of. So
when did the Resurrection Punk Show, can you remember when that actually started up?
Probably around about 81, 82. I was originally doing it by myself because there was Sundays used to be specialist Sundays. So we had a soul show and a jazz show and a reggae show. And so I said, well, you know, we might as well have a punk show as well. I originally did it for, I think, about 6 months or so, and then Neil came along, and he was just such a gold mine of this very rare stuff. And so it was great to play it, you know, rather than just rehashing all the classics every Sunday for 6 months on end.
Mm. But it was something interesting that Simon Gregg mentioned when we were talking to him, was that in the 70s, prior to sort of 1980, BFM didn't actually play punk rock at all. They just were not into it. And it wasn't until, he says, till the Andrews were here, that right. would have been Topping and yourself, that...
And Dickens and Hawthorne.
Yeah, and the rest of the Andrews, exactly. that embraced...
Well, them. Absolutely. It was the stuff coming out. It was the stuff we were going, you know, we were going to see these bands. It was being released as singles, and we felt that it was up to us to play it. And it was also pretty much the stuff that we were into and had grown into university age with. And, you know, I think we were very lucky back then to have a bunch of bands of quality and the fact that they could record and put the stuff out, you know. So pretty much this was the, you know, the first New Zealand punk song I heard, being obviously a first track, A-side of AK-79. It, to me, was just fantastic. It was, you know, great sound. It really rocked, and that really was what got me into it. When it first came out, I was doing a little bit of part-time work down at the record warehouse, which I guess is an old record store that doesn't exist anymore. And it was just a fantastic thing, you know. So, Mr. X. So much more really good New Zealand music out there, and I loved going to see bands, and they would come up and play and or would be here in town. And along came The Clean, and I just really loved that the sound. You know, Point That Thing was just this amazing song, and you know, Flying Nun put out the record, and they came up and played, and they were really nice people, and they. I still have a small part in my heart for Boodle. You know, it was to me a great EP, and this is a song from it that I think you know sums up. You know, kind of what you can do with your life. Anything can happen. We'll be right back. So one of the cool things about Neil just basically bringing in a whole bunch of different stuff from mainly America was that we were exposed to US hardcore, and most of the stuff that we'd been listening to was the UK, you know, kind of pub rock and just general classic punk rock. And along came this kind of American hardcore, and even though there was like a, you know, just a not a hatred for the US, but just America and its foreign policy and so on, there was, you know, this slightly different sound. And it's one of the reasons I chose the song is because it has this fantastic intro, which was just really great, and it sped up and, you know, slowly sped up and comes in. And it was like my first real introduction to the US hardcore. And funnily enough, I still go to the occasional hardcore show, and it's that I always liken it to the Pixies, where it's that slow down, quiet verse, and then the massive, ridiculous chorus, and then you know, so MDC and John Wayne Was a Nazi.
For the record, can you tell us a little bit about the Andrews? Much has cropped up over this documentary series about the Andrews.
The Andrews were, Andrew Dickens was a station manager. Myself was assistant station manager. Andrew Hawthorne was the music director. And Andrew Topping was the program director. And then we had Dave Reed was the tech. So we wasn't all Andrews. But it just so happened that we were all called, you know, blessed with the name Andrew. And that was pretty much the management team at the time that I was here at B. We actually, at one stage, we hired ourselves out as a commercial radio station to 2XS in Palmerston North. And they did a station 2XO in Owakuni. And we all had to change our names. Well, everyone but one had to change names so that we didn't confuse the locals. I remember Andrew Dickens, I think, called himself Rusty, for God's sakes, right? You know, so there were some pretty crazy names going on when we did that. But 2XO was fun, and, you know, it's interesting the kids are doing things in Owakuni again.
Yeah, that's right. So how did that work? They just contacted you and you sort of said, yeah, well, we'll pack up all the gear and chuck it in the van and drive down.
Absolutely. It was the way the on-air studio was designed was so that it was mobile, that it could be moved to do exactly that. And the only way we could raise funds at that time was to, you know, hire ourselves out. And so we actually had this kind of second set of record library that was all these commercial records that we'd been given over the years. And we'd take that with us in the whole studio, and we set up in down in Owakuni and, you know, did this radio station to the ski fields over the August school holidays, you know, because they didn't get a very good reception from anywhere up there. So it was really good for the town. You know, they had, you know, their own local radio station for, you know, news and events and all that kind of stuff. And for us, it was great because we just got treated like rock stars, you know, and you know, we would go out for free and eat for free, and you know, people would wave to us on the streets and so on. And it was a really good time. Yeah, I had blue hair at the time, so there was a bit of a giveaway. You know, it was we had a really good time down there, and we did a pretty good job on it. And for me, that was also when I first made some contact with the people in commercial radio, and I think that that definitely was a big part of leading to me to get a job on 89 FM. Mm. After I had two failing years at university, because I spent all my time up at Radio B instead of actually doing things like going to lectures and going to do you know, quarterly papers and all that kind of stuff, I ended up hanging out up at 89 FM, helping them get ready for the actual launch of FM in New Zealand, helping them put things on cartridge and so on and so on. And once again, hung around enough so that one time they said, hey, do you want to do the midnight to dawn shift? And so that was how it started. And it was, you know, a good thing to do. There was, and, you know, I was able to have maybe a small influence on what we played and so on. So, you know, I think it was all worth it. It was also, I think, that, you know, was this proof that you could do college radio and you could end up in commercial radio. And there's so many people now that have done that that jump. I don't know. I was in No Tag, the punk band at the time, but here I am playing commercial music. But to me, it was like, you know, that was my job, right? Mm. You know, I could be making widgets, but, you know, I was on the air playing commercial music. At the time, I was still doing the Resurrection Punk Show because I kind of, like, still wanted to keep my Radio B roots. And you know, and again, at the time, I was still doing No Tag as well. And so, you know, I wanted to keep up the fact that I was still playing punk rock on the air as well as playing Madonna. It was good. You know, after a while, they kind of didn't ask me to, but hinted that it might be good that I wasn't going on air on Sunday nights and playing really loud, noisy punk rock, you know, right? So
I'd like to talk now a little bit about your own band. As you said, the first one was The Regulators, which you started in high school.
Jeff Hayden, the bass player, went off to play in the Dabs. So I ended up hooking up with Mark Sullivan, who was he'd been in the Flicks. And we met at a Screaming Mimi's concert. And we'd previously, back when we were like 12 years old, been in the same guitar school. He said, what are you doing? And I said, not much. So we got together and we rehearsed for about 6 months or so, just me and him writing songs. And it used to be that one person would pay for practice and the other would pay for the half a dozen beer, and we'd swap each week. And then we ran into the Von Wetering brothers and got it together, and suddenly we had a band.
So that was No Tag?
That was No Tag, yes.
Who are under 30 years old, and there's quite a lot of them listening to PFM nowadays, can you explain what Oi is?
Oi was a English kind of pseudo movement. You know, really, it didn't mean anything at all. Well, it didn't mean too much to us, and in the end, we actually tried to stay away from it because there were so many negative connotations. And as a band, we tried very hard to be non-negative, use the power of punk to make statements about police tactics and so on, and anti-racist things and so on. And so we I think we filled a void that was there, and but we had the same normal problems of bands at that stage of, like, no one would let us play, and not many other bands wanted us to play with them, or really the Oi thing was kind of just there at the time, and we didn't really embrace it fully.
The name of the band, No Tag, sort of says a lot. You were not affiliated with any particular movement. You were No Tag.
That was the absolute meaning of the name, was that we didn't want to be classed into you're this type of band or you're that type of band. But obviously we were a loud, noisy punk band.
That's right. And I think because the Oi thing was very big at the time, you guys got quite a devoted following of skinheads. There were a lot of skinheads in Auckland at that time, and I think a lot of skinheads would go to your gigs.
Absolutely. It was, it was really good because there were places like the Rising Sun. And, back in those days, you had to drag in your own PA. When you were putting on a gig, you had all of that cost. And that was also probably why we always used to play Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, was to make enough money to pay for the PA. Not to mention that you had to lug it upstairs and plug it in and everything else like that. And then, of course, wanting to be as sonic as possible, we'd try and get the biggest PA that we could and to be as loud as we could. So we were lucky that we had this kind of like guaranteed headcount that we could rely on, and places to play, like Edinburgh Castle was another place upstairs there, Reverb Room,
yes.
Yeah, and I think we never got the actual door take record, but we always had the bar record, so they loved us there.
And who were some of the other bands that you would share the bill with? I think Dum Dum Boys?
We played a couple of gigs with them out in halls, again, because, there wasn't that many venues. We would play Mount Albert Hall and Mount Roskill Hall, and it actually got to a stage where we would make sure that we went on second on the bill of, say, three bands to make sure we could play, because if we were last on the bill, by the time it got for us to play, the police would have come and broken it up. So we generally like to get as many other bands that weren't necessarily punk to play with us. I know we played with Prime Movers at one stage. We played with Eight Living Legs because we loved them. Lots of bands, and then other times we were the support band, so just to actually get a gig. So
now, No Tag did put out a record, I remember.
We put out two records.
Oh, there you go.
The first record was the EP, which now sells for ridiculous amounts of money. Recently, someone found a link on a site called Discogs. It was selling for 122 euros, which works out for about $250 New Zealand, which is just outrageous. And I know one just went on Trade Me for 80 bucks. I should have kept a case of them. But we did that because Propeller Records approached us and said, would we like to do a record? And we saved up the money and paid for the recording and gave it to them, and they put it out, and it sold very well. After that, we wanted to do another record, but we really couldn't afford it. So we ended up doing this live record, which didn't come out as best we wanted it to be. It was over a weekend at the Reverb Room, so go figure, right?
Wow.
First of all, we choose a place called the Reverb Room to record in. That's why it was called Can We Get Away With It, because the possible answer was no. And I believe that still, sells. I think someone said they saw one at Real Groovy recently for $100. So, so again, I should have kept it. Well, we all sat around in a pub, of course, on an evening, and knew that the best we could do in New Zealand, being with the genre of music that we were playing, was just not make any money out of it, not to get super big, not sell a whole bunch of records or anything else like that, just because the population couldn't afford it. And Mark had been living in England and wanted to go back, and so he said, "Well, why don't you guys all come?" It was decided that we'd all save up our money and go, and so that's what happened. At first, we were all going to go together, and we had this great idea that we were going to get a Greyhound pass and cross through the states and take our guitars with us and play gigs all the way across the states, and just this pipe dream, really, because it just doesn't exist that way. But it ended up that the singer was had a real job, and he was the one who got the money together first, and so he decided to go early, and then Mark, the bass player, had to stay behind because his dad had got a bit ill. And so myself, Carl, the drummer, and his brother caught the Greyhound up to San Francisco, because there was a guy who'd been living in Auckland who we knew, who said, come on by. And so we ran into him. But we didn't know exactly where he lived. Didn't have an address or a phone number, of course. We just knew he lived in San Francisco. We arrived about 1 o'clock in the morning. We booked ourselves into a hotel, and we woke up the next day. And the only person we really knew, or people we knew, were the Dead Kennedys, because we'd supported them here at good old Main Street when it was still going. And Neil Cartwright had been very good pen friends, if you want to call it that, with Jello. And so we went down to the Alternative Tentacles office and said, "Hey, do you guys know where this person lives?" And thankfully, being a musician, him being a musician, they did know where he lived, and they hooked us up, so we had somewhere to stay. But it was really cool at the time. First of all, the person we stayed with was living on Haight and Ashbury, so we were right in the middle of it. We saw the Mekons do an in-store at a record store, which was just fantastic. It was kind of like, welcome to overseas. This kind of thing exists and happens all the time. But anyway, while we were there, Jello was very busy with the whole Frank and Christ poster thing. But we were kind of sitting in their, smelly old couches, lounge, and just sitting there not doing much at all, reading Maximum Rock and Rolls. And Jello came out and said, "If you guys aren't doing anything tonight, would you mind coming along and singing backing vocals on our new record?" And we kind of sat there and just stunned and said, what do you mean if we're not doing anything? I think we'd just sell our grandmothers to be able to sing on a Dead Kennedys record. And so we did. And we caught a cab down to Hyde Street Studios, where it was recorded, and went in and ended up singing on three songs. So, it was fun. And then they gave us one of the first credits on the record as well. So it's called Chicken Shit Conformist, Like Your Parents.
Heart's not dead, it just deserves to die when it becomes another stale cartoon. A closed-minded, self-centered social club. Ideas don't matter, it's who you know. If the music's gotten boring, it's because of the people who want everyone to sound the same, who drive the bright people out of our so-called scene, till all that's left is just a meaningless fad. I've got one leg of darkness, check me carrying on what we are. Is it sustainable? Or just another labor? The giant hope of an alternative has become a democracy. A hearseless and a lifestyle. And that's a synthesis at 35. Who needs a seat and the love and the feel? Such everything by my pursuit of feel. Who played last night? I don't know why I forgot. But diving off the stage was a lot of fun. So we got the police, the rest of the police. So we got the police, the rest of the police. Make the same old mistake again and again.
Chicken for the like your parents.
what's ripped us apart even more than drugs are the thieves and the goddamn liars. Ripping people off when they share their stuff, when someone falls on their any friends. Harder core than thou for a year or two, then it's time to get a real job. Others stay home, it's no fun to go out when the gigs are wrecked by gangs.
About 86 was when we left and went over, and you know, when we got to England, we would rehearse you know, once a week religiously, and would play about once every 6 months, and you know, at kind of the smaller indie venues. There was a small contingency of New Zealanders that would come and see us, and a few other people. Yeah, the London years were interesting. We wrote some new songs, and but again, didn't record much of it. So, yeah, and so it's basically live cassettes, if you remember cassettes.
Yeah.
Right, are pretty much all that really exists of that kind of thing. But, you know, we had a really good time. It was you know, London was a great place to be. So, but the band kind of fizzled out after about 4 years. So.
Tell me what you were doing for work over there.
I was working for Rough Trade Distribution, which is Rough Trade, the label, also had a distribution arm that distributed Mute and 4AD and other indie labels, and it was part of the Cartel, which was a lot of small English distributors at the time, like Red Rhino and Revolver and so on, all as a group, and we had the centralized warehouse in London that I ran. And it was great. We had, you know, a very large selection of records. We had a massively loud sound system, and we would just sit there and pick and pack records all day long, listening to the latest tunes. And you know, there would be, you know, stuff would come along. You know, I mean, it's like, you know, the first time I heard the Pixies, and first time I heard so much stuff. You know, because we would get the release, and you know, and it would be selling well, so someone would go, "Oh, we better play this to see why it's selling so well." And it was great. Whenever a record ran out, whoever was first to the stereo would win, right? You know, and you could just grab something off the shelf and go for it, right? You know, and you know, we had some big releases, like you know, we did the Smiths' "Strange Ways," "Here We Come," and Depeche Mode's "Music for the Masses," and things like that. And you know, we actually got to a point where we could actually put records at number one in England, and you know, yeah, it became quite a big operation. Well, Rough Trade had an operation in America where they had sales offices in New York, but they also had sales offices in San Francisco, and their warehousing and distribution was in San Francisco. So they basically transferred me over. You know, it was great. They paid for all my records to be freighted over and so on. Unfortunately, the English company went bankrupt about after I was in the States about 6 months. Because the American company was owned by the English company, the American company had to declare bankruptcy. So that was kind of interesting, being, you know, in the United States, and even though I had a work visa, you know, I didn't have a job anymore. You know, I found myself helping, you know, sell off all the assets of the bankruptcy. And then really didn't have a job, and kind of went and did some temp agency work, but you know, really just didn't want to be a file clerk for the rest of my working life in America. My girlfriend at the time, who is now my wife, had a friend who was doing some tour management. So I actually ended up doing a bunch of roadieing across the United States for, well, it was Godflesh to start with, but they never made it in because one of the members had a drug conviction and they couldn't get him a working visa. A friend of mine, another New Zealander, Levi, was doing sound for My Bloody Valentine, and because I had an American driver's license, I was perfect to be able to drive the truck and do the back line. So I went and did My Bloody Valentine, and then I heard the Chills were coming across, so we went out with the Chills, and that was fun because they were just fantastic people. And so that was another 6 weeks. And then the tour manager from the Chills was working for PJ Harvey for their first or second tour. So I went and did PJ Harvey for a while. And then after that, I ended up basically knowing that you can't really go on the road if you want to have your own band. You know, you can't just like have something going and then say, okay, guys, I'll see you in 6 weeks. You know, it just doesn't work that way. So I kind of laid off it and didn't really want to do anything along those lines, but I ended up doing one last tour with Guy Clark and Alan Toussaint and Joe Ely in this like songwriters showcase thing they did, and that was really cool. And you know, like to be introduced to all of that music and to actually meet the people like Guy Clark, who's just a legend, you know what I mean, and hang out with them and go and shoot pool after the gig and everything else like that was just really cool. But then I hung up my roadie boots and got some real jobs doing distribution. Then I worked for a retail company, a big toy store called FAO Schwartz for a while, again running their operations and warehousing and so on. That finished up, and I decided that I wanted to get back into music. And at the time, there's a lot of dance music happening, and particularly drum and bass, and there was a drum and bass distributor called Pulsonic. And I went up there and talked to them, and they kind of had an opening. So from there, I got back into the music industry, albeit now in the whole dance genre. At the time, my wife and I decided that there was so much stuff out there that was like really cool coming out of American producers, but there was no vehicle for them to be able to get all their stuff out. And we decided that you know, we had enough money put aside that we could afford to do this. You know, we would even go to England to master the stuff, to try and make it, you know, sound like the English stuff. And it was really cool. There was just this whole crew in San Francisco called Funkatec, and they were putting out some really good stuff. And so we ended up doing a record label called Green Label and put out 13 records, 13, wow. 12 inches over a period of about 4 or 5 years. So one of the tracks I want to play now is from UFO exclamation mark. He's just this amazing, crazy guy who produces this stuff. And he presented us with this record, and we just lost it. We couldn't believe it. We'll be right back. Believe it or not, I am back at university. I have done the complete circle, and now I'm back at university in San Francisco doing web design and computer-based studies, albeit that this coming semester I have to do algebra.
Algebra.
Yeah, it's a prereq for some of the programming stuff. So, yeah, I've got algebra when I get back and next week. So,
well, I guess having learnt the lesson from 1980, you'll know to stay well away from the university radio station.
Yeah, actually, the thought crossed my mind. I have to be honest about this. I thought, maybe I can just go and check them out. But you have to be in the broadcasting school to end up on the radio station, as far as I can tell. So, and like I say, yeah, I need to achieve A's and all that in the marketplace, because, just B's and C's as doing web stuff just ain't going to cut it, especially in the Bay Area.
Music for you recently?
Currently I'm playing in a three-piece kind of power pop punk band called Alleged Masterminds, and it's funny because the bass player and the drummer are both guitarists, so we've got a band of guitarists, but luckily enough I'm the one that gets to play guitar. It's fun. We've done some recordings. I was actually hoping to do some before we came across, but that got postponed. So when I get back, we're going to do another three or four songs, and it's definitely fun. For me, I think I'll be playing until the day I die. It's just such good fun, and there's so much just great therapy out of a power chord, out of a Marshall at full blast. You know what I mean? We also do this, still performing as Alleged Masterminds. We do this punk cover thing where we do all these old original punk songs about once every three or four months. We play at a nightclub in San Francisco called Bondage A Go-Go, which is this kind of punk goth nightclub, and the bass player is the promoter, so as far as he's concerned, we can play there whenever we damn well want. And so we do this punk cover thing, and it's really fun because I've always said that playing covers, you learn other people's style, and so by playing covers you're teaching yourself stuff. And and of course it's punk, so it's pretty damn easy as well. So, and it's just a whole bunch of fun. And I want to take the opportunity to also thank you for getting this together, because I think it's a great idea, I guess it's like respect your roots and that kind of stuff. I've been listening to it on the podcasts, and it's just great to hear the stories and to reminisce about all things B.
Thank you. What song are you going to leave us with, Andrew?
You can't beat Iggy Pop, and this is just a rule to live by, and have a lust for life. So thanks, Auckland, and the rest of the world listening on the internet.
Beating my brains with a liquor and drink. just a modern guy. Of course I had it in my ear before. Could have lost for life. Could have lost for life.
You have been listening to the BFM Historical Society, a weekly documentary series made to commemorate BFM's 40th anniversary. The Historical Society is broadcast every Saturday morning at 11 a.m. and is replayed as a podcast from BFM's website later on in the week. The BFM Historical Society is recorded at BFM by Dubhead.